Welcome back to Open Source Startup Podcast. This is Tim from Essence VC and lovely co-host Robbie from Conway Ventures. And we're super excited to have Loophole Labs, which are building the developer primitives for the next generation of applications. So welcome, Shivansh.
Thank you guys for having me on here. It's really exciting.
We are thrilled to have you here all the way from Waterloo, Canada, one of my favorite places in the world. And on this podcast, we love to start at the very beginning. So why don't you kind of walk us through where the idea for Loophole came from, and then we'll journey out from there.
Yeah, sure. So Loophole actually started as an experiment back when I was still in university, I guess, like 2 years ago. So our thesis was that if you give a developer better primitives, or I guess building blocks, right, then the applications that they build on top of those primitives will innovate much faster than if you were kind of handcuffed to the limitations of like the existing tools, right? So as an example, I guess if you took RPC, right, applications use RPC messaging patterns all the time. And, you know, gRPC is arguably the most popular one. So if you were to somehow improve gRPC in a very meaningful way, the applications that you build on top of them, those get compound benefits. And then the applications you build on top of those also get compound benefits. So that was kind of our thesis. And so that's what we did. We built a better mousetrap effectively, right? We built something called FRPC, which is like an RPC primitive, right? That was our project here. So we wanted to build a Perl 3 compatible RPC framework that was meant to be, you know, 3 or 4 times more performant than something like gRPC, but not just faster. You know, it also had to be lower memory footprint. It needed to be much more flexible. So if you wanted to drop out of RPC and switch into like just raw byte streams, for example, so you could reuse those TCP connections, totally should be able to do stuff like that. So, and that's what we built. And that kind of helped us validate that, okay, if you build a better primitive, then the stuff that you build on top of it, it's going to be better too. Today, we're much focused on a slightly different goal, a much larger task, which is to build a new networking primitive, you know, tailored for developers. So when I was at IBM, you know, one of the toughest things we had to deal with over and over again was to configure the networking for applications. As everybody moved to the cloud, networking got more complex, right? You have your IP addresses, your VPCs, your routing logic, your DNS, your SSL. And then if you're doing anything fancy, you need Anycast. You got to do all of that before the traffic even hits your application. And so what we wanted to build was a completely new way of thinking about networking, a primitive, you know, from the ground up. Like, what if your application could bring its networking with it, regardless of where it was running? It doesn't matter if you're running on fly.io or a GCP or, you know, an EKS. It doesn't matter, right? Your application brings its networking and its configuration with it. And as part of that, you know, we've been working on primitives below the networking primitive to actually make that possible. You can't just start, you know, from their purpose. So we took a step back, we built a new RPC primitive, we built a new serialization primitive, and now we're working on a plugin framework called Scale that we've actually just open sourced, which will allow people to actually, in theory, write edge middleware that will run in our networking primitive, like at the edge. So they'll be able to customize its functionality.
Yeah, you got a lot of primitives, which I think is super cool. So let's talk. I think we can see the outputs. We can see your thought process a little bit on making things faster, right? And making things a lot more pluggable, making things a lot more simpler to write, I assume, for a certain kind of application. I think when you talk about the next generation of applications, right? What kind of applications are you talking about? Like, why do we need all of these new primitives to empower everything? Because, you know, you could arguably say we can just keep using gRPC, we can keep using whatever. We don't have to use new primitives. It's not as fast, right? Maybe not as snappy, not as cool. It doesn't have purple colors, but we still can get stuff done though, you know, in some level. Why do you think people would rather jump on this? Because there has to be some enabling factor where, hey, it really is 10 times harder or 100x harder to build this. What are those applications, right? And what do you think is the new steps for people to take to build those?
Yeah, so what we believe in at Loophole is like compounding capabilities, right? So you don't build a new primitive because it's faster. That's something you want, but that's not why you build it. You build it because it has new capabilities or it's removing the handcuffs of the existing capabilities. So like I said, with FRPC, for example, one of the capabilities that we added was that you could drop into the raw streams. And so if you're a networking application, once you've done your authentication and you're just going to send HTTP traffic, you don't need to be serializing it over and over again. So to do that, you got to drop into the raw TCP socket. You just straight up can't do that with gRPC. Or you can, but it's very complex and very tough. And so, you know, that's a very obvious example. But if we go much higher up, one of the things we always wanted people to be able to do was just start an app that needed some sort of networking and not configure the cloud environment that they were in to provide that networking. So what I mean is, let's say you have a web app, like a Next.js app, right? What if you could just start that Next.js app and it would give you a domain name, and great, you can just connect to that domain name. Notice we haven't talked about where you started that app. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if it's on my laptop or running on a Raspberry Pi or running inside a Kubernetes cluster. It just, as soon as the app starts, it's networked. And then if I start another instance of an app, maybe in a different country, it should just be load balanced, right? So those kind of unique capabilities that just aren't possible today, right? A really grand example that we like to use is, and one of the things that we've been working on in the background with this new networking primitive, which we're calling Link, is, you know, what if your database could live migrate itself to be closest to the largest number of users? Or your Zoom instance could migrate itself to be closest to the most number of connected users, give it the lowest latency. Well, you can live migrate VMs. That's something you can totally do. But live migrating a network without any pre-configuration, yeah, it's not going to happen. So, you know, we want to give applications these kind of superpowers. And to do that, you got to start from the ground up. You can't just augment an existing piece of system.
So the concept is super interesting for what you're building. And I think, like, one of the things that a lot of founders struggle with and have such a big vision, like what you're going after at Loophole, is where to start. And so, like, now you have primitives around WebAssembly, you have networking primitives. Where did you start and what informed that? And what are some of the earliest decisions you've made around what to build?
Yeah, so we started by looking at what we wanted to build, right? We know what Link needs to do. We have a set of capabilities, a set of superpowers, right? A basic core set. It's got to be deployable really easily. It's got to, you know, be able to bring networking with it. It needs to be globally available. So it's got to support Anycast or not support Anycast. It's going to be open source, so it's got to be self-hostable. Those were the core ideas, right? Once you have those core ideas, we started to work backwards. Okay, what's possible today? What's not possible today? Live migration, not possible today, right? Okay, so that's one thing that we're going to need to build. We wanted users to be able to bring their code to the edge and run it as part of the networking app. You can't use webhooks, which is your standard way of doing plugins, because that's too slow, right? So, okay, it's got to be powered by WebAssembly so we can actually run it inside the application. So as you start to work your way backwards, you get to, okay, well, I have WebAssembly, but there's no well-defined way of serializing data in and out of WebAssembly. Great. Now we need a serialization framework, right? And so you work your way back and you start building these primitives. Originally, actually, before we even knew we wanted to have edge middleware for users, what we really wanted was just to be able to send data really quickly. And so that's where FRPC, because that's a very obvious pattern. You send a request, you get a response, right? And so, you know, with FRPC, we were able to identify, you know, we need a better messaging framework. So we built that. We need a better serialization framework that we built Polyglot. Now, one of the things we had from the very beginning was that if we're going to build a new primitive, it's not just going to be for this app. Anyone's got to be able to use it for anything. And a great example of that is, even though Polyglot was designed for an RPC system, it's totally functional for a WebAssembly serialization framework, right? It's a true meaning of a primitive. We were kind of trying to go on with that. It can be plugged into other applications. And yeah, after that, the growth was very organic, right? We built a better solution to the problem and people used it. They liked it. And that said, okay, great. This solves this problem. And so now we can move on to the next piece of the puzzle and to the next piece of the puzzle. And you know, now we're here today where we have a full-fledged framework for adding, you know, plugin systems into your application that are strongly typed. I mean, that's not something. Why did we do that? Well, because we needed the strongly typed functions, right? Like, you can't ask somebody to build middleware and not give them concrete contracts on what kind of data is going to be going in and what kind of data is going to be out. You need tracing, you need debugging. So we had to add that. So it's been a very organic system. It's I guess people would call it product-led growth, but, you know, we call it our users wanted this and it made sense to add to the product.
Maybe talk about, like, who your users are, because I think when it comes to, like, WebAssembly, we all know WebAssembly exists, right? We're all using it behind the scenes for browsers, but truthfully, like you said, the tooling is so early that it's not like we all want to write WebAssembly or compile our code to WebAssembly yet. Yeah. So there must be a reason why I want to adopt this beyond a browser, right? I talked to quite a few other WebAssembly related companies, and everyone's trying to solve, like, a particular kinds of developers with their particular kinds of problems and trying to win over them in that particular sense. But I feel like you're actually a bit more, like I said, more primitives less about a particular middleware, less about a particular application, but I'm sure you probably attract a certain kinds first. Like, are these people that are starting to use your projects, are they building like a Figma type apps that requires fast plugins with complex apps? Or are these like, you know, Envoy, you know, plugins, I need a better firm? Like, where do you see adoption coming from? And what was the reason that they choose you instead of other options?
Nobody really wants WebAssembly, in my opinion. And this might be divisive, but they don't care, right? WebAssembly is a build target. So is x86. People don't want x86, right? You can't have it both ways. What people want is the capabilities of WebAssembly. They want the fast starts. They want the portability, the safety, the sandboxing, right? When you take that approach, a primitive is what makes more sense. You can absolutely target individual types of developers. There's nothing wrong with that. But if you look at it from the perspective of what if WebAssembly is just an implementation detail, you can go a lot further. And so, you know, with something like Scale, yeah, we haven't targeted, like you said, any specific developer. What we've targeted is the plugin ecosystem, right? If you want to write plugins and you want those plugins, or effectively functions, I guess, right? If you want those functions to run inside your app, right? So not webhooks, right? And run inside your apps, then you need to use WebAssembly. But like you said, it's not a fun process. And so what Scale does is it hides away as much of the WebAssembly as possible. In fact, almost all of it. So you call Scale build instead of your standard WebAssembly build tooling. Because like Golang, for example, the Golang compiler up until very recently couldn't even compile to like WASI. And so you call Scale build. We do all that hard work for you. As a developer, you write a function, right? We call Scale build. And then you can use that function inside your existing application. So it's that simple. The word WebAssembly is only mentioned when you ask, how is it safe? Or why is it so fast? That's when we bring in the WebAssembly. The developers that we've been targeting and actually have been more interested in us than anything else are people who want to take existing applications and start augmenting them. That's a very popular use case, right? Think of something like Terraform. You can write plugins for Terraform in Go. What if you could write them in TypeScript? That's a very real example of things people are doing with Scale, right? And the nice thing that we did was because we were motivated by eventually Scale was going to run as middleware for effectively what is an API gateway application, it needed to be chainable. So you would want to be able to bring multiple functions and chain them together. Well, that unlocks a whole new series of use cases. One of the things we've been seeing people do is use it for audio plugins. So you have some input coming in from a microphone and you can layer on top multiple plugins written in multiple languages, right? And it'll modify that. Okay, so we took that as an example and we said, well, you know what else should layer multiple transformations on incoming data? Kafka, right? To transform data and or data transformations for artificial intelligence, right? These are very real applications that can absolutely benefit from arbitrary code being run in a safe, efficient way, right? And that can be layered together. And so it was very organic. People were like, I have this problem. This is obviously solving this problem. You know, languages like Terraform, obviously not the HashiCorp guys themselves, but people are writing Terraform plugins in TypeScript. And there's no reason not to anymore, right? Because you've kind of solved that very core issue of cross-language compatibility. I have a favorite library in TypeScript I like to use. Well, I can't use that in Go. So either I got to rewrite it or now I can use Scale. And it's a very, very simple path forward.
So Scale is still fairly new, from my understanding, released earlier this year. And you also have your RPC framework. How are you thinking about just building out the either suite or going deeper on certain functions? Like, is the goal to just keep building for what the community wants and some primitives or projects are going to get like wider adopted and you'll double down on those? Or what's kind of just like your thought process around what to focus on at this point?
In my opinion, when you build an open source company, which is what Loophole is, right? All of our products are open source. It's a mixture of two things. You know, the community wants things, and absolutely, if it's feasible to deliver those features and products, should. At the same time, you're a startup, right? And so you need to be focused. You can't just keep building in whatever way the wind blows, right? So our goal is to build a networking primitive. And it's a different story if like a large set of users want a feature, because, you know, the whole point of it is that it's open source. So if it's something that we can, you know, work with our community on and get out there, right? Like if a contributor wanted to come in and add a capability, like that's one of the main benefits of being an open source company. Absolutely, you can add that benefit and we'll even help you, right? And so our end goal is to build a networking primitive that is able to make use of scale. It's also to augment existing API gateways like Envoy and Kong and all these other guys and say, great, you can now write functions to augment these existing systems. It just makes sense, right? On the other hand, we could have just written one specific signature or one specific typed function for scale and say, scale can only work with HTTP functions. It won't work as a plugin for your arbitrary application. We could have totally done that. But we didn't because, you know, we knew enough of the community wanted this, and we knew that there was going to be a long-term benefit from being able to change the types, the actual structures that were going to be going in and out of these functions or going across the WebAssembly. We knew it wasn't a solved problem, right? And so if we were going to be the first people to solve it, and we were in a really good position to be one of the first people to solve it, it really just made sense to us. And it wasn't something that detracted away from our final goal, which is, you know, we want people to be able to write different kinds of plugins as well, not just be hampered in by, it's got to be an HTTP request. And so it just makes sense. So if the community wants something that very much detracts from what our roadmap is, the whole point of us being open source is that, you know, absolutely you can do it. And, you know, we'll even help you, because that's the whole point.
Yeah. And given such a quite a low level system, I think it's also to be able to be gain trust for the users to build, like, especially RPC layers, serialization formats, and all that stuff. Yeah, it's definitely a no-brainer. I guess really intrigued and curious about how you sort of prioritize the things you should build, because when you say a plugin, and I want every language it would call each other, there's so much nuance of that. So, like, there's a lot of different kind of types you need to support, right? There's a lot of kind of edge cases around the toolings you need to be able to do this. And most importantly, is like, how do I debug this, right? I call a TypeScript, my Golang, and then something failed. And you have this like really weird looking thingy that I was like, how do I read this? WebAssembly debugging is like one of the most frustrating thing anybody could probably imagine experiencing. You know, it's like a core dump with a core dump kind of feeling. And so there's endless stuff you could probably build to make the experience much more better. How do you, like, think about what are the most important things we should really able to prioritize and polish? And how do you also get your first users to adopt it when everything is so early as well?
Absolutely. So one of the most beautiful things about the way we do engineering at Loophole is we dog food by design. I think that's the right way of putting it. So scale is going to be a part of Link, right? We know that from the very beginning. And so what we're able to do is put ourselves, as we're just even writing the code, in the shoes of the developers, because this is a very real way we're going to use this, right? Stuff is not going to work. We live in the real world. So debugging is very important. So that's how we knew we needed to add debugging. So one of the things you can do in scale is you can trace, which is, I think, like one of the only ways that you can actually debug WebAssembly properly is like you will pass in input data into a function, and we will tell you every single thing that happens inside that function. It's not a standard dump. It's more like I can watch a variable and see its value change, like what you would expect when you pull up a debugger, right? And the nice thing is that will work even if it's embedded in your app, even if it's a plugin. Like this kind of stuff needs to work, because from the perspective of a user, because we are our own users, we can tell that that's something we're going to need. Right. When we look at plugins, why did we not decide to make it just specific to HTTP? Well, it's because as a user, right, this capability, we ourselves want to use it for other applications. Let me give you a real world example for us was the Golang regex library. The Golang regex library is not fast, but the Rust regex library is. Right. And so what if you could use the Rust regex library from Golang? That's a very real use case that we wanted to look at. Right. And we did. We benchmarked it. And when you compile the Rust regex library to a scale function, you get 4 times better throughput, even if you're calling it from Go, right? That's a very real world capability. So in terms of how we decide what to focus on, it's very much, well, if a user asks us, can we do this? Or even if we ask ourselves, can we do this? We just ask ourselves, I'm a user. Is this a very niche operation? Which is, if it is, that's fine, right? It's an open source product. You can add it yourself. But if it's something we think a lot of users are going to need, and if it's something that we can see is definitely going to solve a real world problem, then it becomes a no-brainer to implement. And that leads into our answer for, you know, how do we get our initial customers? I mean, if it's solving a real world problem that is previously unsolved, customers will come. If it's a real problem and this is a real solution to it, and there's no downsides to it, or there are very few downsides to it, then again, for the customer, it becomes a no-brainer to use it. I mean, why would you not use it? Then you'll just have that problem, right?
Yeah, I love dog fooding everything that you're building, because I think that just shows this appreciation for the product. And also you can debug it, your users, yourself. I actually wanted to dig into something that I thought was really unique about your hiring process, because you are very public about even the process that candidates go through. And I'm sure that there's been a lot of thought into the type of people that you want to attract to work at Loophole. So especially as a first-time founder, like, how did you kind of think about that? About, okay, we're going to be really, really open about how we hire people here and the types of things we look for in a way that is pretty unique.
Yeah, I think it all starts from the fact that doing what we do is not easy, right? Imagining a completely new primitive and removing handcuffs from the stuff that's been used for years is not an easy task. And one of the things that we do at Loophole, and I've kind of started to become more public about this, is we tell all of our engineers, it only has to be possible, right? Like, all you need before you can start approaching a potential solution is just tell us it's possible. We'll figure out if it's the best solution later, right? What that's led to is straight up breakthroughs, right? In the way that we do things, like the way that we move live migrate a VM across data centers, across countries, right? While keeping a network connection intact. We do a demo where we have like a Minecraft server that's running in Frankfurt. We bounce it to Amsterdam, completely different cloud provider, every 5 seconds. We have somebody connect to that Minecraft server and try and guess when that migration happens. And you can't even tell. That kind of breakthrough does not come easy. And so, you know, one of the things we did with our hiring process was we wanted to find people who were very willing to look at these problems that everyone else has said are impossible or too hard to solve, or you can just do it this way, and say, no, listen, there's a better way of doing this, and we're going to make it a reality. And we don't know how hard it's going to be, right? But we know that it's possible. And as long as we know that it's possible, we can go and actually make it a reality. And our hiring process effectively builds into that, right? So we have three principles that we kind of came up with to try and find these kinds of people, which is we have to trust you and you have to trust us, right? I'm a first-time founder, right? And so, you know, it's the real world, and the first-time founders often will make mistakes, or at the very least, we'll do things and we're not 100% sure of whether this is going to work or not, right? And so the only way that this works is if you can trust your team to tell you, Shiv, I don't think this is going to be a good idea, and here's why, right? And kind of build that culture of everybody is right, nobody's wrong, there's no bad ideas. You can't do that without, from the very beginning, going out and saying transparency from even just from the hiring process, right? And so we make it very clear to all of our candidates, this is exactly what you're going to do to get hired here. And, you know, if you can do this, great, right? Then there's a level of respect, I think, that a lot of companies seem to forget, or specifically around engineering time, which makes no sense to me. You're paying them, your engineers, for their time, right? So respect it. And so we try and do that again from the very beginning, which is we go to our candidates and we say, listen, we will not go over a certain amount of time. We're going to respect your time and kind of tell you from early on, you know, exactly how your time at the company is going to be. We're going to respect your time. If we didn't think you were a good engineer, we wouldn't have hired you. But we're paying you, so we trust you. You use your time the way you think you should use it best. And then principle three, we assume competency, right? Engineers are expensive, very expensive, okay? If you're going to pay them that much, the least you can do is assume that they know what they're doing. And if you can't assume that, don't hire them. And so, you know, we don't do the technical interview. Personally, I hate them. I always used to fail at them. I was much more interested in figuring out how TCP as a protocol worked than trying to figure out how to solve that lead code question that was going to be on an interview. I think that makes me a better engineer because I can solve the problems that, well, I mean, you're not solving the problems that lead code has in the real world. Otherwise, why would you get hired? So if you're going to solve the weird problems, the new problems, then you want to find somebody who can think outside of the box. And a technical interview does not do that at all, in my opinion. So we were very, very focused on kind of, you know, we want to attract candidates. We want to make it easy for them to interview. And the first two things, you know, the first two principles make that. And then if they're going to interview with us, let's assume they know what they're doing. We'll find out during the interview very quickly if they're lying, right? Because we are all very high-level engineers, but we can drop into low level whenever we want to. And so when we're doing these interviews, we'll start off by talk about your project, right? At a high level, we know nothing about it. But as we start to understand exactly what you were working on, we can start to go deeper and ask more questions. If you can't answer those questions, it means you don't know what you're doing. But if you can, then we can safely assume that you know what you're doing. I mean, if you have open source projects that are out there and you can answer questions about them, you likely didn't copy them from someone else, right? It's very rare that people do. stuff like that. So if you respect the candidate enough, it's much easier to gain their trust. And once you have their trust, you can build a better company culture. And that just helps as a first-time founder. It just helps to have people who are deep in the company, who know what you're doing, who understand your customers, you know, because they're right there with you and can give you their thoughts and ideas without being worried about retribution. And I actually get that from IBM. My old boss at IBM used to do that. And it was incredible for me.
That's amazing to hear. So let's maybe talk about how do you think the projects will progress? Because I think we haven't really touched on the commercial value of what you want to bring. I know you're early, you know, everything here takes a while. You're building a community, you have a Discord, you have regular status events. So I can clearly see you're trying to bring a lot more adoption to the things you're building. And I think it will be pretty exciting for everybody. Type functions available to do all kinds of plugins. We definitely can see that happening. And let's just assume you gain traction. What do you think is the products versus project sort of separation that you're looking for? Like, how do you make a commercial product around this? Do you see yourself building toolings around this that's proprietary? Do you see yourself doing some kind of hosting with some particular applications? I just want curious how you think about the commercial value.
I think when you sell to, and sell being like pitch, I guess, when you have an open source product and you want to pitch a developer to use it, they have to see the value in it very quickly. I think people call it the aha moment. When you want to monetize a product, you have to make sure you monetize it after the users got to the aha moment. And so if you take that very simple principle and you apply it to open source, you can understand that for most people to see if a product is useful, they're going to need some basic set of features, right? So let's take Link, for example, right? They're going to need the ability to spin a self-hosted node up. They're going to need the ability to, you know, start an application, give it Link credentials, and then start their Next.js app somewhere in the world and have it connect and do all the things that you advertise that it does. If it doesn't, because you've hidden it behind a paywall, then I think, you know, that kind of fails from a commercialization perspective. Once it's done that, the question is, how much more useful can you be, right? Once you've fulfilled the initial goals, you draw people in with a pitch. Once you fulfill that, the question becomes, how much more useful can you be? And at that point, I think you should start thinking about commercialization. So with something like Scale, it's an open source runtime. It's effectively a wrapper around very popular production-ready WebAssembly runtimes. And that wrapper allows type safety and chaining and hides away the WebAssembly, right? That's the aha moment, is you can use WebAssembly from other languages, and that's really easy. As people grow and start to use it, there's a very easy opportunity for us to charge for support. And or one of the really cool things that we've been looking into is stored functions. So if I write a function in Rust, how awesome would it be if I could then go get same function in Go, right? Because all we're doing is we're wrapping all of that Rust code in WebAssembly and then building the templates required to actually run that, and then just doing the serialization in the background. You send in an object into your function. Under the hood, we're calling WebAssembly and we're doing all that stuff. But that's a really cool way of monetizing this, right? You can do it without this online registry that you can go get from. But if you use this online registry, look at how easy it is for you to take like your JavaScript function and just use it from Rust, or a Rust function, use it in Python. It's as simple as pip installing, right? So that's a very commercializable system, right? It's a hosted service. It doesn't encroach on the aha moment of Scale itself. It just adds capabilities to it. So, you know, that's the approach we've been taking. We come up with a very clear approach to this is what we think people want, and this is why we think people will be excited. And our free product, our open source product, will fulfill all of that. As people start to use it, it's very easy to come up with, oh, I bet this would also be really cool. But obviously, this is going to cost us to run. This is a service that we're going to charge for, right? And so again, organic growth, just looking at what your customers want, looking at what your customers need. With Link, it's the same thing, right? We'll have a self-hosted version. We won't charge for that. We'll have a hosted version that will give you an Anycast network and will give you, you know, a lot of performance. And you won't have to rely on AWS or GCP or whatever. And like, great, the original product does all of that. This just makes it easier. It's worth paying for, right? It's got to be value add, especially in this economy. You have to be a value add.
And I'd love to talk a bit about the community side of things and what you've learned so far, because I believe that Loophole is kind of your first foray into open source. And so between content and community building on Discord and like how to allocate your time to different community building activities, and also how to like take feedback from the community in Discord or other ways, like what are some of the things that you've learned so far that you think would be helpful for other open source founders to know?
I think the most important thing when you're doing any sort of open source, but also if you're a startup building open source products, is just don't have any ego. Be happy with being wrong, but be wrong once, right? Learn from your mistakes. And so the really nice thing is if you're building an open source product, you follow these tenets and you try and keep your ego in check, which, you know, I would like to imagine that I'm starting to get better at it. If somebody gives you a suggestion, instead of trying to think about whether or not the suggestion is right or wrong, try and figure out why they give you that suggestion. What are they missing? And you'll find two things. One, either you did something wrong, and we do that all the time, right? Or maybe you evaluated some input incorrectly, right? Like you thought people would want this, and in reality, people are going to want, you know, something completely different. And we did that, right? We thought for the longest time that people wanted to run WebAssembly functions as microservices. And we did that because we saw some other companies looking at it. We were also interested in it because it gave us a really good way to dog food link. We're like, oh, we'll build up our own like deployment platform and we can dog food link to the routing. But we were wrong. People are much more interested in being able to take their WebAssembly functions and run them inside their apps because you can already use AWS Lambda. There's a myriad of serverless options in the world, right? And so, okay, great. You get the fast startup times with WebAssembly. And some people like that. Like, don't get me wrong. It wasn't 100% zero, right? But being able to take that kind of feedback and say, listen, we built a thing. Maybe we were wrong about this. We're still going to keep it. We still want people to be able to deploy. But, you know, focusing more on this plugin system is going to be more of a value for multiple people. And, you know, we frankly lost sight of it ourselves. We built Scale to be a plugin system for Link, right? We didn't build it to be a cloud platform. So we were wrong. And, you know, taking that community feedback and reorganizing, you can only do that if you don't have an ego, honestly.
Yeah, I think you already alluded to some really valuable things. And especially like people that, I guess I'll call it like us, because we all built more like runtime systems type of developers. We want to solve problems and we know what we're solving based on our experiences. And we know I want to be also be proud of the kind of work we're doing as well. But having like a lens into the market, what people actually need, what they actually really care about, is quite different. And what are the key lessons you learned during this process? Because I think you already talked about that you had to really rethink about what is going to gain user adoption and traction. And we often hear founders talk about, oh, we just changed and here's the new direction and everything just grows much more faster. But the nuances, there's so much more nuance in there, right? Like, how do you get the team motivated? How do you get, you know, yourself over the line? Because it's not clear data, I would say, right? There must be things you have to really consider, because the more obvious direction sometimes more competition, for example, right? Or whatever reasons. What are the things you didn't know about and you learned along this journey when it comes to like process of running a team and also learning about finding product market fit that you wish you knew before you started?
I think the first thing would be nobody knows what they're doing and everybody's learning. I think that would be my big thing. Sometimes when you start a company, you look at how other people are doing things and you're like, I should do it just like them because I see that they're successful, right? But that can be completely wrong, right? There are other companies focused on WebAssembly microservices, right? And I'm not saying whether they're right or wrong. I'm saying for us, that didn't make sense. But for a very long time, we were worried that if we didn't go the same route, because of course the other companies know exactly what they're doing, or the way people do hiring. Everybody does technical challenges, right? And or technical interviews. I mean, why wouldn't we? So I think in that way, you just have to show up and talk to people, people who use your product, people who don't use your product, people who work for you, people who don't work for you, people you will maybe never consider hiring, and people you would totally consider hiring. And just get as much information as you can. Don't assume that anybody knows what they're doing and you should totally just follow along with them. Just, you know, focus very much on talking to the community, talking to people, talking to users, and be completely willing to think, oh shit, maybe I should have done it this way. Or maybe my approach was wrong. And again, this leads into that hiring process. Your engineers are going to be your biggest resource. And Loophole's engineers are our biggest resource, right? Our engineers talk to our users. They know what's going on in the community. They're not just these siloed components that you give work to and they split out work. That's not how we wanted our engineers to function either. All right. Everyone is open and everyone is able to kind of make decisions together. When you do that and you work under the assumption that, you know, maybe it's okay to be different or do things completely differently or take a different approach, that's, I think, the real superpower, is knowing that it's okay to do something that maybe the industry doesn't accept. Because if you're just going to do the same thing over and over again, first of all, that's really boring. But also, like you said, the competition is going to grow. So you got to differentiate yourself. And what better way than just to try and innovate at any step and every step that you can? There's no way to do that other than asking people what their problems are.
Yeah, I love the first principles approach to so many ways that you're building Loophole. And there are so many nuggets in here for other open source founders. So thank you so much for joining us. This was a really awesome episode, Shiv.
Thank you so much for having me, guys.